Good evening, everybody. You've tuned into Paradigm Shifters. And who are Paradigm Shifters? People who are making a difference during this shift time in our collective on this wonderful planet Earth. And I have a Paradigm Shifter tonight to talk to you, who really made a difference with his book, a doctor who made a huge difference with your book, Love, Medicine, and Miracles, way back in the early 80s or late 70s. I remember it had an impact in my world. Let's welcome to the show someone who's got further books, and we'll talk about those tonight, Dr. Bernie Siegel. How are
Hello.
You, Dr. Siegel?
I'm fine, thank you. And the book came out, in the late 80s. I started this work in the late 70s, but then finally got together and put a book together in the 80s.
Well, it came out around the time my husband at the time had a brain hemorrhage. And it was a really, I don't remember the book very much, and somebody stole it in the hospital, but I remember that for a while it got us.
That's a good sign, right?
And hopefully it made a difference. That person was obviously a paradigm shifter as well. But I love your latest book, 365 Prescriptions for the Soul, Daily Messages of Inspiration, Hope, and Love. And I loved, I popped it open, and it said, "What is a miracle?"
Mm.
I love that. Do you want
what
to talk about that? That was prescription number 222.
Because, you know, what's interesting, I reread it regularly because it's almost like writing it, you're in a trance. You know, things come out of you. So when I reread it, it's like, wow, did I say that? That's good.
Well, what it says here is your mother called it God's redirection.
Yeah. I mean, the first quote is from Einstein. I mean, because I start, you know, at the top, what is a miracle? And he said, there are only two ways to live your life. One is as though nothing is a miracle, and the other is as though everything is a miracle. And
that's great.
It, you know, but my mother, she was always into, you know, God's redirections. And according to her, nothing could ever go wrong. And as a teenager, that drove me insane. Because, you know, just picture yourself coming home after having a horrible day at school and saying, Mom, I had a terrible, it was meant to be. God is redirecting you. Something good will come of this. And I would go to my room and think, my mother just doesn't care. And I literally talked to God. I always shut the door so that, you know, they wouldn't say, you need therapy. You know, you can't talk to God. But, you know, what I learned was that she changed my view of the future because I began to realize that at times something happened that would upset me, that I didn't want. You know, it could be very simple, where you want to go to college, who you know, what girl you want to go out with, what job you want, and it doesn't work out. But then a week or two later, or a month or two later, something else happens, and you say, wow, this is great, but it wouldn't have happened if the other had happened. And so she, as I say, gave me what I call mottos to live by, because I meet a lot of people who have said to me, you didn't ask me what mottos I'm dying by, you know, the things their parents said to them. So it was only after I grew up that I realized I had really good parents in the sense of the messages they constantly gave me.
That's wonderful. So you became a doctor. Did you have any, big redirections when you became a doctor, and how did you become a doctor who paid attention more to miracles?
Well,
than
I was an artist as a child. I did a lot of painting and things, but as crazy as this may sound, I never knew about artists and that you could earn a living, you know, selling artwork. I don't know. I just did things, but never got involved in art in a general way. So when it came time to choose a profession, I didn't think, you know, I didn't want to be an interior decorator, you know, I just thought a lot of practical things if you had a sense of artistic. And I thought, you have good hands, you like people, you could be a surgeon. So I put together, I liked people, had good hands, liked fixing things, and science was fascinating. So I said, okay, I'll go to medical school. The problem arose when I realized you like people, and you like fixing things, but you can't fix everybody's problem. And then it really got painful. And that is something
that's a little wounding, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I still write about and talk about that medical schools are just beginning to deal with, you know, death and loss and all the things that you really need to look at if you're going to care for people. Because doctors, you know, are trained to think and not feel. And the feelings are buried. And you hurt yourself as well as your patients. Oh, I mean, I was just reading an email from somebody who had heart surgery and said the surgeon only talked to him twice. Once before surgery and like a week later. And another doctor from the hospital dropped in a couple of times. But he said it was horrible. You know, that there was no connection with the doctor at all. And what I've learned was that if you're criticized by patients, nurses, and family, then you're a good doctor because they know you're willing to learn from your mistakes and change. And I mean that literally, that if you ask your doctor or you criticize, the really good ones always answer yes, because people know that they will not make an excuse and blame the patient or the disease or something else, but they'll take responsibility and be willing to learn. So I'm always saying, the Sufi poet Rumi said, criticism polishes your mirror. I'm sure it's probably one of the topics in this book. But, you know, you become a better person if you see it as coaching, in other words, people telling you how to do something better, and not that you're a terrible person. So a good coach knows how to criticize or give feedback and improve the performance of the person that they're working with. Yeah.
Well, tell me, were you always, and thank you for that. That's a really good thing for us to remember. You said you used to go to your room and talk to God, right?
Yeah.
So were you always kind of spiritually driven, like wanting to know more about?
It's interesting in that my grandfather taught, he was an Orthodox Jew, and he taught Judaism, and that's why he left Russia, because he was being persecuted. And he was my teacher, so that it was very different in the sense that he and I would spend evenings reading, talking, and I wasn't caught up in the what I'd call the rituals, if you know what I mean, that what you had to do on a certain day at a certain time if you were going to be, you know, in a religion. And so I was always comfortable with God. I mean, I always say I was loved by my parents. I did well in school, and I got along with God. So I didn't have all the problems everybody else did. And so I was always comfortable with religions and began to study them as I became a physician because I also realized how much trouble they caused. Let me give you an example.
Oh, you were aware of that even as a young guy, huh?
Yeah, I mean, the guilt, the blame, you know, is God punishing me, all these things that were a real problem. And one that really struck me in my reading was that Pope Leo XII, I think it was in 1824, he declared that if you vaccinate yourself or your children against smallpox, that you're no longer a child of God because God decides who gets smallpox.
Oh,
and,
Lord.
You know, you read something like that, and it's like, wow. And I think that, you know, lingers with a lot of people, even though it may be changed. So one of the things I often say to people is, if you lose your car keys, does God want you to walk home? And they laugh at you. They say, no, I go look for my car keys. I say, then if you lose your health, let's look for that too. And that came from
great, a
Jewish physician and philosopher, Maimonides, because he said, disease is a loss of health. So if you find what your neighbor's lost, return it to him. And I may add one other quote from him that kind of blew my mind. Let me give you a test question, all right?
Okay.
You have eight cats. This is a true story. You have eight cats. One dies of lung cancer. The others are having breathing problems. And you and your husband smoke. What would you do?
Well, either give the cats away where they can be safe or I quit smoking.
Neither one is what is in the letter to Cat Fancy magazine. And it's interesting. I'll tell you, but what's interesting to me is you have magazines called Cat Fancy, Dog Fancy, but you don't ever have a Human Fancy magazine, how we feel about ourselves.
We have Fancy Human magazines.
Yeah, that's true, but that's a different perspective. But this woman wrote in saying, in the last paragraph, Doug and I now smoke in the yard. See, we're not killing our cats anymore. We hope you're not killing yours. because she didn't mind the inconvenience of smoking outdoors. We're not killing our cats anymore, but they're killing themselves. And Maimonides wrote 900 years ago, if people took as good care of themselves as they do their animals, they'd suffer fewer illnesses. To me, that's why I write, and the saddest things in the world. I'm trying to let people know I love them. They are divine creations. And to abandon the wounds of the past, you know, what your parents, teachers, clergy, doctors have done to you with their words, let it go and accept your own divinity. And I mean that literally. We're made of the same stuff. What I like to do at schools, I did this at a graduation. I often, if I'm going to a school, ask any of the teachers if they've recently had a baby to bring it. But I was speaking at a graduation, and fortunately, a woman came in with this baby. So I borrowed it, and I held it up in front of hundreds of people. And, of course, everybody goes, oh. Then I picked up one of the students, and everybody burst out laughing. See, and then the point I make is, what are you laughing at? What's different between the two, you know, a few years? Why are you laughing now and in awe of the baby? You know, and then everybody grows quiet. And, yeah, one of my suggestions is get your baby pictures out and put them where you live and work and acknowledge that child and, you know, treat yourself with that respect, too, and honor yourself and love yourself.
That's actually brilliant. Good for you. So tell me, you do a lot of work with, I know you do speaking and so on, but you work as a doctor, don't you? Do you work with a lot of dying people? You work with a lot of seriously ill people?
Yeah, I was a surgeon who did a lot of adult and children surgery. And then because at a meeting where I was trying to help deal with my feelings, one of my patients said to me, I need to know how to live between office visits. And I thought, oh, that could make me feel helpful to everybody, even when I couldn't cure them. And so we started support groups, and that was over 30 years ago. So, yeah, I'm not doing surgery anymore, but still running the support groups and lecturing and teaching. And again, it's the kinds of people who come are a special group who are willing to participate in their life and their health. You know, that death is not a failure, I didn't do it right, but they're willing to take part and not see themselves with guilt, shame, blame, and all the things that others are afraid to get involved in.
Well, we talked last night, and you said you had some stories about working with children with terminal cancer and laughter.
Yeah, there's so many things that I would say. One of our children taught me something. I mean, he's an adult now, and he is alive. But when he was 7, he was complaining that his leg hurt. And I said, take a hot bath. You know, he's a little boy. I figured he hurt his knee or something. And one day he comes to me, and this always blows my mind. He's 7 years old, and he says, I need an x-ray. I thought, what do you know about x-rays? And he says, I need an x-ray. So we took an x-ray, and he had a bone tumor. Now, the likelihood from the x-ray is that this is a malignancy. You know, like a 95% chance, really. The odds are he has a malignant bone tumor. His father has told him to take a bath, and we have to amputate his leg, and he'll probably be dead in a year, because this is a number of years ago. There wasn't much he could do. And I went home totally depressed after seeing his x-ray, and we have 5 children. And I try to get across to all of them that your brother's going to be dead in a year, so everybody...
Oh, it was your own son.
Pardon? Yeah,
that was your own son.
You know, it was basically telling my wife and the others, everybody should be depressed and go sit in your room because he'll be dead in a year. See, that was my problem, if you know what I mean, as the doctor.
Yes, I do.
Yeah, I wasn't listening to what my mother said. I was now living in this horrible future. And the next morning, Keith came in to me. Remember, he's 7 years old. He said, Dad, yes, can I talk to you for a minute? I can still hear him say it. I said, what is it, Keith? He said, you're handling this poorly. and he went on to explain, we're trying to go out and play and have a nice day, and you want us sitting in our bedroom depressed. And he went out, you know, and taught me that what we're supposed to do is enjoy the day and live each day. And the kids and animals understand this, you know what I mean? They're not worrying about next month. And we were very lucky. He had a very rare benign tumor. But the week before surgery, I learned a lot as a parent and from him, you know, to live, enjoy the day. And that was another part that got me writing, that people would come to the group, change their lives, and then not die, okay? And now we know this is scientific. It's like, what messages do you give your genes? Say, well, you know, Monday morning, we have heart attack, strokes, suicides, etc. So when you don't love your life, yes, your body responds to that. And in a sense, your body's trying to do you a favor. You don't want to go to work today? Okay, we'll have a heart attack. You know, it's just responding. But you wake up filled with love and joy, and you have a very different life. I mean, another one from one of our kids, because they're all very wise. Think what you would answer. If I said to you, starting right this second, you have 15 minutes to live, what would you do? And we were talking to a group of people, and some of the answers I didn't think, you know, were very intelligent in terms of what people would choose to do with the last 15 minutes. And when one of our sons said, I'd buy a quart of chocolate ice cream and eat it, I said, you're enlightened. I don't have to worry about you. But then somebody else said, but what if my answer was my chocolate ice cream? And I loved that. Because then I began to realize what I like, you know, what's my chocolate ice cream, you may not like. So that's how I was reacting to people. But we each have to find our chocolate ice cream. And that when you...
Well, I wanted to do three things. I wanted to phone my kids and your grandson and meditate.
Yeah. And that's why it isn't wrong, you know, to answer that way. Because if that's what would make you feel good about those 15 minutes and how you spent them, yeah, at the end of 15 minutes, you may not be dead because it felt so good living that. Matter of fact, to reflect even on hospices, because I keep thinking so many stories, the best hospices have dropouts and graduations because people go there to get their lives in order, see, preparing to die. And then when their lives are in order, they say, may I go home for a while? I feel too good right now. And really, that's how I judge a good hospice. If nobody ever leaves, then they're into death, not life.
That's wonderful, actually, yeah.
The other, I'm just thinking of other children that, one boy, too, because I often ask these things at workshops because they've happened to me. You walk into a 16-year-old who was dying of cystic fibrosis, and he pointed that kids his age were playing ball in the street, and he's in the hospital dying. And he turned to me and he said, why am I different? And that's when it's almost mystical, because I know that I didn't decide to answer him with what I said. And when he said, why am I different? I said, because it makes you beautiful. And then I thought, what a terrible thing to tell a dying child. So I'm ready to apologize. And I turned towards him, and he had this beautiful grin on his face and loved the answer. And I can tell you, he has, yes, he died, but he lives on with fundraising of millions of dollars for other kids with cystic fibrosis. So he very much is still alive and did so much. Yes, I spoke at his high school because he invited me, and it goes on and on. And that's something also you begin to realize, that sometimes a curse can turn into a blessing because of what it leads us to do and what it leads us to accomplish. And you know, the parents who are screaming, complaining, mad at God, you know, 10 years after a child dies versus the ones who are raising money to cure the disease, you know, that took their child, it's such a different response than what it means to the world.
It's very pro-life, isn't it?
Yeah. Last night I was at a high school and spoke, but it was a night where kids were raising money and then having their heads shaved. This was to help, you know, prevent and treat cancer and so forth for cancer research. And, you know, to have high school students come in and have their head shaved is quite a step. And it was wonderful. But you see, that, you know, where is this coming from? Yeah, it's coming from troubles and wounds that have occurred to other people, you know, other kids who had cancer. But these kids are stepping forward to do something about it rather than living in fear or anger, you know, and resentment and everything else.
That's great. When you were a doctor, you were a surgeon, and then you wanted to change into being a writer, what was it like to go from, you know what I'm saying? It's like, did you have a huge, like a dramatic shift from?
No. I mean, as a matter of fact, the first book would never have gotten written except that somebody said to me one day, have you ever thought of writing a book? You see, I mean, one of, like, in my prescriptions, one of them, I think, is there's, like, no coincidences, if you know what I mean.
Right.
You know, and it's even, what is a miracle? I mean, it's like, who do you run into? What happens? Why are you in a certain place at a certain time? I mean, Carl Jung said, well, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who was an old friend, always used to say, there are no coincidences. And Carl Jung said, the future is unconsciously prepared long in advance. So one day somebody said to me, you ever thought of writing a book? I said, well, I mean, I don't know how, I don't have a... And the next thing, you know, they talked to somebody who talks to somebody, and all the people showed up who said, okay, now write your book. We got it all together. And what I've learned is to become a storyteller, because the worst grade I got in college was creative writing, because I was a science major, you know, coming out of my head. And what you learned.
But you were an artist. Artist as
yeah,
well. Yeah,
that right? part, but that was visual, see. With words was another thing. I remember something, William Saroyan wrote a story in which a young man is working for a writer in the army. And the writer comes in and says to this young man, you're a good writer too. And the young man says, what are you talking about? I haven't written anything. He said, oh, I saw that letter on your desk to your father. That's really well written. He said, that's just a letter to my father. And the writer then said, okay, then write a letter to everyone.
Oh, that's great.
And that's what I learned to do, because I would write to people, now I email them, but from my heart, you know, I don't stop and think about it, I write. And basically, sharing all the stories and thoughts is, you know, and then having somebody help edit it and put it together became a book. I mean, now I need less help, because I know how to tell my stories and write things. But as I say, it's got to come from your heart, not your head. And the other
did
is,
you have any adversity? Did you have adversity when you started to talk and bring consciousness into the medical?
Again, yes, there was a lot of resistance. I was on all the famous talk shows with people yelling at me, other doctors. You're crazy. you're asking people what happened in their life before they got sick, so you're blaming them. You see,
that was back in the 70s.
Yeah, see, but again, this is how I was brought up, you know. I mean, in my house, if something happened, again, yeah, my folks would say, okay, let's look at what's going on in your life, what can you learn from this, not what did you do wrong to make yourself sick. So it was natural for me, if people came in, I'd say, what's happened the last couple of years in your life? You know, that could make you vulnerable. See, now we have scientific studies that show loneliness affects the genes which control immune function. So, again, those were things I was seeing happen. You know, a child may die. You move. Your husband is in an accident, whatever. You get a divorce, and then something happens. Okay, let's look at your life and what's going on. Because, again,
now, Were you doing that way back when? Were you doing that with people?
Mm-hmm. See, and yes, and the physicians, what I mean by that is psychotherapists, psychiatrists knew what I was talking about. Because what was fascinating is I did a lot of work with dreams, with drawings, things I learned from Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, Jungian therapist, and I thought I was discovering incredible things. So I wrote articles, sent them to medical journals. It came back. This is interesting, but it's inappropriate for our journal. So I sent them to where it was appropriate. It came back again, and it said, this is appropriate, but it's not interesting. And I realized all these people knew what I was talking about. As a matter of fact, I had a wonderful letter and got to know him very well, Dr. Carl Menninger, the psychiatrist, because when I sent him a copy of my book, Love, Medicine, and Miracles, he wrote back, he said, I was about to write a book called 12 Hopeless Cases. These were 12 people considered hopeless who are alive and well today. He said, I don't have to, you did it. And you
The
psychiatrist, Larry Lachon wrote a book, You Can Fight for Your Life, a psychotherapist. These were people who were treating individuals with life-threatening illnesses, helped them get their lives in order, and then noticed the benefits to their health. And that's the part we're beginning to understand now, that your genes don't make decisions. You know, they're activated.
That your genes are influenced by your mental
state. Yeah, it's like
your
chemistry, what's called epigenetics. Mm-hmm. I mean, that there are other molecules that trigger off what gene does something. I mean, one of the things, for instance, you have identical twin sisters. And if you ask an audience, who's more likely to get breast cancer? The little devil who's running around doing her thing, or her sweet sister who makes mommy and daddy happy and internalizes anger? And everybody votes for the sweet sister who, you know, is making mommy and daddy happy. Yeah, and it's true. So that's why you have to realize, again, this. See, the problem becomes how you brought up teachers, clergy, politicians, doctors. If you feel guilt, shame, and blame, then you interpret this as, oh, look what I did wrong, I made myself sick. But if you interpret it as responsibility, participation, then you look at your life. How can I help myself? What can I do? What do I need to change? So if you're hungry, you don't say, oh, my God, I'm hungry. This is terrible. No, you get something to eat. So when you don't like how you're feeling, go nourish your life. And then you add to your survival.
Well, I love that actually. I love the ugly duckling 298. Yeah. Do you have something to say about that? And your mom said when she gave birth to you.
Yeah.
I mean,
what
you might have had an emotional scar from that, right?
Yeah. What number is that one?
It's number 298. Said
right.
When you were born.
Yeah, I didn't learn this till I was an adult, because in our family album there are pictures of my mother standing behind a covered carriage. And I assumed you must be sleeping. But I don't know what got us discussing this, but my mother was quite ill with hyperthyroidism and weighed practically nothing. And the doctors told her, do not become pregnant. It'll threaten your life. Well, she did. And then all kinds of complications at time of labor and delivery. They said, you can't survive a cesarean section. We need to get this kid out of there. So after several days of my mother, as she said, screaming in the hospital, tearing up the sheets in labor, they pulled me out. And she said, I was not handed a child. I was handed a purple melon. And I said, and what happened? She said, oh, we wrapped you in kerchiefs, your father and I. We took you home, put you in a carriage, covered it, and put you behind the house so nobody would see you. And I said, then why am I not a drug addict or an alcoholic? So that, you know, nobody's touching me. And I often say this to people. See, what would have saved the ugly duckling? Because when I read that to our grandchildren, it really hit me suddenly. Here's this poor little guy whose mother throws him out of the house, and he finds his reflection in the water. And that's a whole other theme we could get into. But the symbolism of the water and the reflection. But how many ugly ducklings ever look in the mirror at their reflection and say, hey, you're really beautiful. Your mother's the problem. Yeah. And so my mother said,
but you didn't grow up all neurotic as a result, huh?
No, but I had something that the ugly duckling didn't have. I had a grandmother. And my mother said she took me from my parents and poured oil all over me, and 5 and 6 times a day would, to quote my mother, push things back where they belong. But to me, as a child, I'm sure that was a massage, you know? I'm being loved now. And I probably felt like the most loved kid on the planet because of how she was treating me.
That was the massage and the message back to McLuhan.
That's right. And we know what the benefits of touch are to children. See, way back when, in the 1800s, orphanages had just about 100% mortality rates. Kids were dying of infections. And they thought, we better not touch anybody. We're spreading it. No, that's why the kids were dying. Nobody was touching any of them. And so I realized, in a sense, you know, my grandmother made all the difference in the world. And that memory, you know, I mentioned in the story, was stored in my body. Because as an adult, the first time, I'd been massaged before, and I shaved my head in the 70s. That's a whole other story about what needed to be uncovered. It wasn't my skin, but I ended up shaving
my
head.
Why did you shave your head?
I just had this incredible urge. I mean, I had to do it. My kids thought we were nuts. I was nuts because I was embarrassing them. You know, they were wearing the hair to the shoulders, and the father shaves his head. What I learned later, again, from myths and Jung's stories, were that I needed to uncover my spirituality and my feelings. Because he basically said, it's like a monk. You shave your head. It's a ritual. And when I read that, I thought, oh, that's what I needed to uncover, were the feelings spirituality, all kinds of things, not skin.
Was that the beginning of hearing things or having strong intuition?
Yes, I would say at about that time, yeah, that you really mm-hmm. begin to open up to it, and things happen differently. But let me finish that. The first time a woman massaged my shaved head, you know, with the oil in her hands, I literally went into a trance and back into my infancy. And when I
wow.
opened my eyes, the room was filled with people. You know, I mean, I'm there to get a massage. There's nobody. You're in a private little room. And suddenly the room is filled with people. And I said, what is everybody doing here? And they said, we thought you had a stroke or a heart attack. You left. We couldn't talk to you. And I said, I know. I went back to being an infant. So
wow.
those kinds of things have happened to me. Even as a kid, I almost almost died choking on a toy telephone that I took apart and aspirated it and couldn't breathe. And so I've had a near-death experience and left my body and a whole host of things. And all I can say is I've experienced these things. See? So to me, it's not, do you believe in this, do you believe in that? If it happens to me or to a patient I'm taking care of, boom, here's an experience. The fact that I can't explain it doesn't stop me from accepting the fact that it happened. You know, I always mm-hmm. say, like quantum physicists and astronomer, they can't explain how we all got here, but we're here. So accept it and live with it and learn from it.
Hmm. That's exciting. So you actually would you say you've been guided to keep pioneering through that medical paradigm, have you?
Yes, it's, well, and with time, it's more accepting. So mm-hmm. I'm invited by medical students to hospital meetings now and to talk. And we don't get into arguments about, you know, have you done research? Is it valid? Because they know now, yes, it is scientific, and people do respond. See, I mean, as an aside, how powerful the mind is. A radiation therapist was talking to me, and he told me that they repaired the machine and then started treating people again. A month later, they do the, you know, like routine checkup, like you take your car for service. So they're servicing the machine, and they realized they had not put the radioactive material back in. And they've been treating people for a month. Now, I said
Uh-oh.
To him, do you understand what you're telling me? He said, what do you mean? What am I telling you? He said, I'm just telling you about the machine. I said, no. I said, if people didn't have tumor shrinking, if their skin wasn't getting red, then you would have realized something's wrong with the machine. Nobody's responding in any way. And he said, oh, my God. He said, you're right. I said, yeah, go get the records and write about it. But that shows how powerful the patient or any person's mind is. You think you've been defeated. Yeah, and you respond as if you are. And so I use the mind in a powerful way, if you know what I mean, to help people, not to tell them all the things that are going to go wrong, and then they have side effects even when you don't give them the treatment, you know, just thinking about it.
Did you always have that response? Like when you were learning medicine, did you take some years of being normal in it before you began to really plumb the depths of human interaction?
Well, I think so, but I think I was always a little different, and also I trained in pediatric surgery, and I think when you're taking care of kids, it's also different. They're right there, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
It's open, mm-hmm. honest. You can't deny your feelings, and even if you get into spiritual questions, like, you know, if God created this universe, why do this to kids? Why give them cancer and have other problems? So you really questioning creation in many, many ways. And that was me. Yeah, I have to say, yeah, I think I was different, that other doctors can be mechanics and, you know, a lot of medical students say, oh, yeah, the human body fascinates me. What don't they like? The fact that people come in it.
Mm-hmm.
But I was always interested in people.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean that literally.
Yeah, I can tell, actually. I always think that death is not the worst thing. We do a lot of healing into dying, don't we?
Some people agree with each other, yes.
Yeah.
One of the things that fascinated me was when you had a near-death experience. I was out of my body. I literally, when I didn't die, shouted, who did that? Because I, as a four-year-old, thought it was a heck of a lot more interesting to be out of your body, even though the parents would find me dead, and I didn't like doing that to them. But I had no desire to come back. And the other thing that was interesting, but you see, it never occurred to me, how can you watch yourself die? You're not in your body anymore. Mm-hmm. Blind people who have a near-death experience see when they leave their body.
Hmm. Okay. So physically?
No. Yes. Yeah. I mean, there's a whole book by a friend, Ken Ring, called Mind Sight, by people born blind who had near-death experiences and saw it when they were out of their body.
And interesting.
Again, consciousness doesn't end with the body. And how it can see, I mean, I don't have all the answers, but I know that our consciousness doesn't end when our bodies end. And I literally tell people death is not the worst outcome. There's wonderful words, again, from William Saroyan in a story. A young man dies, and the last words in the story are, he leaves his body and becomes dreamless, unalive, perfect. And that's something I also realized, that I do a lot of work with drawings, and suddenly people would draw themselves perfectly normal. You know, they were missing an arm, a colostomy. And suddenly all these obvious things, boom, are gone, and their body is perfect again. And I know in some instances they were saying, I'm going to die and leave my body and be perfect again. So all those things, that wisdom is with us. But I really feel that, well, one of my examples is, you know, to ask people, not to mention Jesus and Abraham, but here's Noah. God comes to him and says, I am going to eliminate everybody. You go build your ark. And it doesn't seem to ever occur to people that Noah doesn't say, wait a minute, I have lovely neighbors. You know, there's a lovely dog across the street. Can I bring him? You know, he doesn't bargain to save a single life. And it struck me, and I thought, he knew what's hard living. And I mean that, that death is not the worst outcome. And what's hard is living. You know, when you say to people, is life fair? Part of why I write these books, you know, they yell, no. I say, it must be fair. You're all complaining. Then they laugh. I say, life is difficult. What we need help with is how to grow up and handle the difficulties.
And you also said in Prescription 103, you said exorcise regularly.
Yeah, it's all these ways of getting yourself cleansed and straightened out. And it's, as I say, I try to make it practical, because that was something somebody was saying to me, you know, that I seem very practical. And I said, yes, I'm trying to keep it that way, and that my messages aren't new, okay? I could point out in myths, fairy tales, religions, all the things I'm saying. But it's easier if I write it in a way that relates to what's going on in your life today and not 1,000 years ago. Yeah.
And it's easy. I mean, for example, this book, you can just flip it open and there's something really
and that's
pithy.
What I do. I mean, it's like, what do I need today? You know, so I'll go over to it and I'll pop it open, and it's almost, I'd say 90% of the time, that the message is very applicable to what's happening in my life today. And the reason, you might say, well, why are you reading what you wrote? It flows out of me in a different way. So when I read it, I'm reading it as if some stranger wrote it. And I'm saying, hey, that's good. That's, you know, yeah, if it's a story about my life, okay. But otherwise, it's, yeah, okay, that's good. Did I write that? Wow.
Have your folks seen your books? Are they still living?
No, my mom and dad have died. I mean, I try to give it to all our children, because they're my teachers, and I'm always sharing stories about them, too.
Talking about children, you work with them. We were talking on the phone last night, I don't know if you remember, and you said, ask me about the working with children and cancer and laughter.
Yeah, it's, I mean, one of the things that I've learned is, you see, and now a study was done. Cancer patients who laugh live longer. The point it made was that, in other words, you didn't have to tell them jokes, okay? You stop and laugh. And the kids, the way I got kids to not hurt, not be afraid, was to be crazy, is the only way I can describe it. I met a gentleman the other day, just so you have a practical example. he came up to me after I gave a talk at a fundraiser for a young lady with cancer, and he said, "You operated on me many, many years ago when I was 9 years old." I said, "Really?" He said, "Yes. I had a problem on my scalp, and you had to operate on it. And when I was in your office, you came in and you said to me, 'I have good news and bad news.'" Imagine what I'm about to say, saying to a nine-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, "What's the bad news?" I said, "I have to remove your head." Can you imagine telling that to a nine-year-old? I mean, I was thinking, why didn't he get up and run out of the office? But I think they all knew I'm nuts, you know what I mean? That,
yeah.
You know, that they sat there looking at me. And
kids can tell.
Yeah, I said, "I have to remove your head." And then he said, "Well, what's the good news?" I said, "I can give you a replacement head. You tell me what you would like." And he said, "I would like Frank Sinatra." And he said, at that point, you hugged me and said, "I love this kid." And then you become family, you know? And I would have pictures on the wall in my office of all kinds of animals and creatures and say, "You want to meet my family?" And then I'd point to all these weird creatures on the wall, and the kids would look at me. But, you know, it distracted them. So I called it deceiving them into health. Or even taking a bottle of vitamins and saying hair-growing pills, anti-nausea pills. And so when the child had a problem, you give them a vitamin, and believe me, it's amazing. See, they have faith in you. Let me tell you how extreme, see, when they believe in you, how you do. In the emergency room, I'd often say to children, you know, "We're going up to the operating room. You'll go to sleep when you go into the room." I'm thinking that they should know they're going to be anesthetized, so it won't hurt. I literally had children fall asleep being wheeled into the room.
Oh,
and
wow.
And I realized how powerful my words were to them. And one boy was really cute. This is how literal they take you, see. We're wheeling him into the operating room. He had appendicitis. And he flips over on the stretcher and falls asleep. Well, we move him over to the operating table, and I turn him back over. And he opens his eyes and says, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm turning you over so I can operate." He said, "You told me I would sleep, and I sleep on my stomach." And, I mean, that's how, you know, every word meant something. And so I reached a bargain with him. I said, "I can't get to the appendix from the back, so, oh, all right, I'll sleep on my back." But that's when I began to realize how literally they took you. And so, again, you see, if you're trained on how to speak to patients, yeah, you can, what I call, deceive them into health. Even with kids, I tell this to nurses and other doctors all the time. You take an alcohol sponge, wipe their arm before you put a needle in, and tell them this is a new medicine that numbs the skin. 30% of the kids would be hypnotized and have no pain from the needle. Just from
that
simple
amazing.
Thing. And the others would say it didn't work or it still hurt, but it was a totally different reaction. You know, it wasn't, "Oh, my God," and all the shrieking. It was, "Hey, Dr. Siegel, that didn't work. Oh, next time I'll get a new one. That one may have," you know, and you keep working at it. But it's something, again, as I say, the doctors need to be trained in how to communicate. There was a psychiatrist and therapist named Milton Erickson who, and there's an Ericksonian.
Yeah, I studied some of his stuff.
Yeah, you know, he had polio as a child. See, he was lying in bed hearing the doctor say to his mother, "Your son won't see the sun come up tomorrow," because he was so sick with polio. And he said, "I'm lying in bed thinking, oh, no, I'm going to see that sun." That taught him something, you know, about the power of those words.
What's his famous line is, my words go with you?
Yeah, and my voice
something
will go
like
with you. Yep.
That's right, because I studied some of his stuff.
Yeah, there's a book by the psychiatrist, I forgot his name, but called My Voice Will Go With You. It's his teaching tales. And he would tell stories, and it hypnotizes people, and I learned that, you know, too, what a difference it made. See, the other thing, very simply, that he did, you're sitting in the office with your doctor. Your doctor writes in your record and then says, "Oh, excuse me, I forgot something, I have to tell the nurse," and he leaves the room. What would you do?
Pick up the magazine beside me.
You wouldn't look in your chart?
No, I don't think I would, actually.
All right. Well, most people say, "I'd look at my chart. What did he write?" He would write "doing well" in the chart and then step out of the room, say. So think of what would happen if you picked up the chart and saw, Oh, I'm doing well. Oh, how therapeutic that is, eh? You know, versus all the terrible things. I know patients who have had disasters being taken down to x-ray, you know, and somebody drops the chart in their lap, you know, during the transportation, and they open it and read things that doctors have said, and it kills them, literally.
Right.
It takes their hope away.
Or even what's said in surgery, even though they're anesthetized.
Yeah. Okay? Yeah, we hear under anesthesia.
Yeah, before we end this, I just wondered if you have a future projection in maybe our human consciousness and healing professions. Do you have some kind of...
Well, the thing I wish is that we would stop exploring outer space and explore inner space. I mean, I think if we invested
it's
all
bigger,
the money
isn't it?
In studying the human body and how it interacts and creates life, I mean, just think of one cell creating a human being, the intelligence, the mechanisms that go on. I think that's really a hell of a lot more interesting than what's going on in outer space.
That's interesting.
I think that what we will be studying more and more is consciousness getting to understand more about what we are and who we are, and that we're not just physical beings, that we're more than that. And how our emotions interact and become our chemistry, and also that what we're capable of in this sense that, see, bacteria, you dump antibiotics on them, they alter their genes and become resistant. Now, you read that we need a new flu vaccine. Yeah, viruses are smart, too. They change to survive. I mean, it's all built into us. So what we need to do is learn how to create these changes in human beings, as Solzhenitsyn said in his book Cancer Wards, so that there are cases of self-induced healing, see? And that's what we need to understand. How do we create self-induced healing? And I've studied these people, and as I say, they all have a story. The essence is you're born again, okay? Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that in some religious perspective, but why I mention how water is important. You see your reflection. You create a calmness. You're willing to see yourself, and you're also willing to become like water. You can become vapor, liquid, solid, so no matter what you run into, you're capable of overcoming it through change. And when your body, see, your body loves you. It's a poem I put in one of my books by John Updike. A scab is a beautiful thing, a coin the body has minted with an invisible motto, in God we trust. Our body loves us. Yes, you cut your finger, it heals. You don't bleed to death. So let your body know you love it and you love your life. And then some wonderful things happen in your body.
That's wonderful.
Growing up with love, one last statement. Go into an assisted living facility. Talk to 80, 90, 100-year-olds. Say, did your parents love you? Everybody says, yeah. Go to a high school and ask that. The majority say no. And what we need to know is the benefits of love and to teach kids to eliminate what's killing them, not themselves or their lives.
Thank you so much. I really loved our time together. Recommend
you.
That people get hold of 365 prescriptions for the soul. Seems like you even have more. Daily Messages of Inspiration, Hope, and Love by Dr. Bernie Siegel. Thank you so much for,
thank you for listening.
All of your wisdom. Yeah. Well, thanks for being a purveyor of wisdom through the sea of human consciousness.
Well, I try to tell people, don't become strong at the broken places. Learn from those who have been broken and become strong enough to withstand the difficulties.
Yay. Well, thanks for your inspiration, darling. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that was Dr. Bernie Siegel. What a wonderful, wonderful, inspiring soul. This is Veronica Entwistle, and I'm going to be giving a workshop in Costa Rica, from March 25th to March 31st. If you want to know more about that, check my website, veronicaentwistle.com. If you have any feedback for these shows, suggestions of guests, I really love Dr. Siegel, so if you've got some feedback on that or anything else, veronica@veronicaentwistle.com. And I will see you on Thursday night on Jackie Salvitti's show as we talk to the team about, we're going to talk about love. We're going to talk about keeping your heart open in these times that are a bit scary at times. And next week is an interview with Aravinda, and I'm not sure what we'll do on Radiance, because that always sort of builds itself up during the week, doesn't it? This is Veronica Entwistle saying, have some love, feel some love, and pass it on. And thank you so much for listening. I look forward to hearing from you, talking to you, and connecting again on lovely BBS Radio. Good night.